Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Once Upon a Time at the Oscars.
The show that takes you through every Best Picture nominee from 1927 to today.
I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And I am thrilled about today's episode.
Very exciting times.
A multitude of reasons, really.
Yeah.
Not only is this the finale of the third Academy Awards season that we're doing.
One.
This is the finale of the podcast. Nope.
I was about to say, huh?
Ta-da, we made it. Covered all 3 years. This is the finale of the first season of the podcast.
Two.
And also, we have a very special guest that will be, how do I say this? We did an interview with a very special guest for this episode that was kind of like a last minute thing. I wasn't sure if it was going to come to fruition, and it did. And I'm so excited.
I'm so excited for everyone to hear it. It's going to be a
so
good time.
Cool.
Do you want to talk about it? Do you want to have a little surprise?
I'm sure we've already promoted it at this point, so you probably know who it is. But if you don't, we did get a chance to interview and speak a little bit about the history of Universal Studios and Carl Laemmle, the founder of Universal, with his great niece, Antonia Carlotta.
Yeah.
So that's going to be coming up.
Probably. Incredible time speaking with her.
It was wonderful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She's so kind. She's so knowledgeable about the history, and it was just a blast.
And no one will ever see it, but she had this incredible background when we interviewed her, and she just had like all these items of like Hollywoodland and Dracula and
yeah.
The Bride of Frankenstein that I think was like the wig of Bride of Frankenstein on a cat. So just incredible
nice.
Work Very on her cool. part. Great backdrop.
Yeah. If you do want to see it, she has a YouTube channel, and we'll plug all that when we have the interview.
Sure.
But
look forward to that. We'll include that at the end of the episode here.
So good. So good. So I'm excited, though, to talk about the movies of the third Academy Awards and everything that went down that night.
That fateful night.
Yes. So this is going to be kind of a long episode, so I think we should just jump right into it.
Let's get right into it. So we're covering the 1930 award ceremony. Now, this specifically was awarding the films that were released between August 1st of 1929 and July 31st of 1930. And Kyle, I am delighted to say that this is the last year where we have to deal with some shenanigans.
Right? Yeah. There's still some weird shift as far as the months that films can qualify.
Yeah.
But this is the last time it falls between two separate years. So no longer do I have to be like, it's the 1930, well, technically, we're done. That's it. We're moving on.
I have to fix something real quick, but while I do, there's something interesting about this awards ceremony compared to the others, and that's that it was held in November. Can you speak to why that was, Kyle?
I assume it's the Depression.
So, I'm sure it's the Depression, could be the title of my autobiography, by the way. So they decided to hold the awards in November, specifically November 5th, to move them closer to the eligibility period. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, okay. So yeah. It's not the Depression.
Nope, not the Depression. Okay. Not this time. So because of that, ceremony took place only 7 months after the second Academy Awards.
Wow.
So fun little fact here, 1930 was the only year in which two Academy Awards ceremonies were held.
Fascinating.
Such an interesting thing.
Thank goodness that happened so that we can just move on with our lives.
That's true.
So this was held at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California. It was hosted by Conrad Nagel.
Our guy.
Right, yeah. First he was hosting the Hollywood Review of 1929, and then he said, you know what? You haven't seen the last of me, because that's how Conrad Nagel talks.
Historically, we've seen him in movies this year.
It's true. And he said, I'm going to host the Oscars.
Oh, he's dropped the voice now.
Yeah. Trickster, Conrad Nagel. So, I mean, where do we go from there? Just go right into it?
We should probably talk about the films that were nominated. And before we even get into their nominations, how many nominations they actually had. So there were a couple films that were nominated here, specifically Romance and Bulldog Drummond all came in with two nominations. That's the lowest amount of nominations so far. Disraeli and Anna Christie came in with three nominations. Disraeli, one of the best pictures that we're talking about here.
It's true.
The Divorcee and The Big House and All Quiet on the Western Front came in with 4 nominations. And that might surprise you to hear that that was not the most, because The Love Parade was actually nominated for 6 separate awards.
Look at that.
Interesting.
That is kind of interesting.
Especially knowing where things fall here. Very surprising to see The Love Parade get 6, but All Quiet on the Western Front only received 4.
Yeah, that is very interesting. As we go into the breakdown of all the nominations, I think that'll probably be explained a little bit to us. But
Or, you know, we'll do our best to explain it.
Yeah, we'll try. I don't think I understand it.
I was hoping you were.
Hey, one thing I want to mention. Academy members were charged $10 to attend the award ceremony this year.
Do you know how quick or how many times I'd pay $10 to go to an Academy Award ceremony?
Dude, every year I would do it. $10?
Well, I would pay $10 300 times.
I grabbed $10 300 times.
3,000?
3,000. Why do you have to do it 3,000
times? I mean, I don't. I'm just saying I would.
Oh, okay. Yeah, me too.
Like if the this year or this coming year.
Yeah, yeah.
If the Academy Awards were like, hey, Ryan, come on out, $3,000. I would do it.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. I'm caught up.
Yeah.
I was like, do you know that many people to bring?
No.
Yeah, me neither.
Absolutely not.
Dude, I couldn't get anybody to go see Kill Bill with me.
I really wanted to go, okay? I desperately wanted to go.
I posted that on my stories 4 times.
But instead, I had to depress myself with probably the 3 saddest Best Picture nominees contenders in a row. So you know what? We both had our sad boy moment.
It's true. It's true. For very different reasons.
That's true.
Let's, we said it's going to be long. Let's get into the nominees.
Let's get into it.
We're going to start with writing.
Okay.
So we had 5 films nominated for writing. And again, this year it doesn't specify between adapted screenplay or original screenplay. I think it's just everything. It's just writing.
Just writing.
Fascinating. So we had All Quiet on the Western Front, The Big House, Disraeli, The Divorcee, and Street of Chance. So this is the first time we've talked about this category on the show where we've seen a majority of the movies nominated.
That's true. I mean, with the exception of Street of Chance, the rest are just in the Best Picture race.
Yeah. The winner this year was actually The Big House. And this is significant because Frances Marion wrote The Big House. We talked about her a lot on last week's episode. Mm-hmm. And big deal. This was a woman writing a prison film that was awesome enough to take home the Oscar. This is the first time a woman won an Academy Award that wasn't like a on-screen talent.
Correct.
So this is a big deal. How do you feel about this winning the prize?
For best writing, I think I feel pretty strongly mm-hmm. about it. I'm in favor of that. I think, you know, spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about All Quiet on the Western Front a good bit with this ceremony, especially in our later conversation with Antonia. But specifically with The Big House, I do remember having a pretty great time with that. And I do remember the writing being pretty great. I wouldn't say that it's much better than what I experienced with All Quiet on the Western Front. But still, Big House, if it had to get anything other than the German expressionist production design that we saw, I think writing is a pretty safe bet.
I agree. This is one of those things where I'm so grateful that Frances Marion took home the Oscar. I think a reoccurring theme for me with this year is, yeah, but it could have went to All Quiet.
Right.
That movie's just such a powerhouse, and you know, I don't want to spoil every category going right. forward.
But to our earlier point though, All Quiet on the Western Front wasn't nominated for everything, right? Love Parade was nominated for a bit more than
this
that.
This is true.
Was.
This is true.
So it's not going to be All Quiet all the way across.
All Quiet all the way down. Yeah. You want to cover the next category?
I would love to. We actually have for the first time Best Sound Recording as a nominee for this year. So why do you think that is? Because obviously last year we had sound, right? But we didn't see sound recording.
I think this is the first year that we got all sound pictures.
True.
You know, the previous year you had
Patriot, which was still half.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And you had other films that were silent that weren't nominated in the Best Picture category, but there were still some silent films that were kind of squeezing their way through.
Right.
This is the first year where it's like, unless you put out a sound picture, you're probably not garnering a big audience.
True. So then sound recording shows up in 1930, and up until even today's standards, we have different versions of sound, but sound very much is on the board.
Yeah.
So the nominees for Best Sound Recording were Song of the Flame, George Groves. I paused a little bit for a little mild applause. Raffles by Oscar Lagerstrom. The Love Parade by Franklin Hansen. The Case of Sergeant Grisha by John E. Tribby. And the winner of Best Sound Recording was The Big House, Douglas Shearer. We've talked about Douglas Shearer before.
Yes. So he was a big deal this year, specifically. He was the head of MGM's sound department.
Right.
So from here on out, really, anytime you're watching an MGM movie, maybe not every time, but a majority of the time, you're going to see Douglas Shearer's name pop up in the sound recording or the sound editing title. He did The Big House this year, and he also did, with his sister, the divorcee,
right,
Norma Shearer. So it's really cool. The people that are in charge of the sound departments for these studios this year, you get to see them continue on most of the time.
Right.
And Douglas Shearer, obviously being a huge, just valuable player for MGM, the head of sound, you know, and it paid off. The Big House won. We talked a lot about the way sound was used in that film. There's that great scene where Butch and Morgan are thrown into solitary confinement separately.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear them have a conversation back and forth between the cell, something you wouldn't have been able to do in the silent era.
Nope. And then you even blend over Butch screaming at Morgan and Morgan singing in that. So again, another example, or another excellent example of a sound and the balance in that.
Yeah.
Still interesting that, you know, with sound, we're not talking about All Quiet on the Western Front with the way that balanced, you know, any kind of war element happening at the time.
Yes. I there's a part of me that wonders if maybe because All Quiet doesn't play with sound in any kind of, I don't know,
experimental,
like, yeah, experimental, kind of like a trick way.
Sure.
Which is kind of how I look at the conversation in solitary confinement in The Big House.
Right.
I don't know if that's the proper way to look at it.
But not to mention the final shootout.
Yes, that's true. The final shootout in The Big House has that really giant prison break scene with Tommy guns and tanks and things.
True. I also wonder if there is a example here of Universal. We talk about how Universal's first nominee here is going to be All Quiet on the Western Front.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's an example here of, or an instance of them not campaigning as much as other studios who have been present for the previous Academy Awards.
I really would like to learn more about what campaigning looked like in these early years, because we mentioned it with Mary Pickford.
Yep.
How she was the first one to really campaign for the Oscars. It looked a lot different than it does now in the modern day. Obviously, studios were concerned with winning Academy Awards, but I don't know if they campaigned in the same format.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I'd be really, really curious to dive into more of that.
Why don't you take the next one for us?
Yeah, so after that, we've got cinematography. For this category, we have All Quiet on the Western Front, Arthur Edison, Annie Christie for William Daniels, Hell's Angels for Gaetano Gaudio and Harry Perry, The Love Parade for Victor Milner, and With Bird at the South Pole for Joseph T. Ruckert and Willard Vanderveer. So we've seen two of these movies.
We have.
Neither one of those won. I did watch Hell's Angels a couple of nights ago.
Oh.
Because that's kind of a really significant movie. And there was part of me that was like, man, I wish I could watch all of these movies so I can really have an opinion on all of this.
Sure.
I just don't have the time right now. But let me watch the ones that have made a huge impact. So that's the Howard Hughes film that I believe he directed, and The Aviator with Leonardo DiCaprio. That kind of tells the story, at least in part, of the creation of Hell's Angels.
Interesting.
That's the one where he gets in a plane by himself because he's like, we're going to do this stunt. And they're like, no, that's crazy. We can't do that. And he goes, I'll show you. And then he crashes the plane. And that affects his life for the rest of his life.
So it's not funny what ends up happening to him, but it's just very funny. That sounds like something I would do where I'm like, watch this.
Yeah.
And then like I do a backflip and land on my neck.
Yeah.
And everyone's like,
you're like Peter Griffin on the floor. Just wrecked.
Yeah, not the best. It's interesting when we talk about best cinematography, because again, you're correct. We're going to be playing the why not All Quiet on the Western Front game for a while here. But specifically, I keep thinking back to one of the earlier scenes in All Quiet on the Western Front where there's troops marching in the streets of Germany, and it's this entire large production with seemingly 1,000, if not hundreds and hundreds of extras. And then the camera just pans out to show that we are in the classroom and the professor is speaking. And we're just watching that scene now with all of that still happening in the background.
It's so good.
It's so good. And to me, that was such an interesting, like, camera, not even trick, but like play.
Yeah.
And I have not seen with Bird of the South Pole, which did take the win for this award, but it's just hard to imagine, especially like with Love Parade. We've seen Love Parade. Great. But there wasn't anything specifically that caught your eye the way that scene and many other in All Quiet did.
Yeah. The fascinating thing, too, is Hell's Angels can kind of hold its own in this category. There is a lot of plane combat and dogfighting. There are zeppelins that explode into flames. And it's really an impressive film. The story itself is kind of in the same way I think that Wings was. I like Wings a little bit more, if I'm being honest. But visually, it's a very impressive movie. So it's funny that, you know, just 2 years later, a very similar film is not wowing in the same way that its predecessor did.
Interesting.
With Bird at the South Pole is actually a documentary.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is this the first documentary that's been nominated?
No, I don't think so. I think actually in the first year, one of the best pictures was sort of a documentary.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was like the life of this native family in the jungles of Africa or something.
Interesting.
I think that's right. I forget. I watched that movie and I don't know where it took place.
Don't worry, we'll correct ourselves.
Yeah, but with Bird at the South Pole, I think was either Antarctica or the Arctic.
Got it.
So I imagine that, you know, the landscape and everything played a big part of that. So I can kind of see why it may have been able to, kind of when we talked about In Old Arizona, you were using natural scenery and real, you know, landscapes. That sells.
True.
So that's my guess.
Interesting. Let's go over to Best Art Direction. So the nominees here are The Vagabond King by Hans Dreyer, Sally, Jack Oakey, The Love Parade, Hans Dreyer again, Bulldog Drummond, William Cameron Menzies, and King of Jazz, Herman Rossi.
And who won?
And the winner is. King of Jazz took the win for Best Art Direction. We talked about King of Jazz a good bit in our conversation coming up here with Antonia, but specifically this was Universal's second nominee that they had in the third Oscars.
Yeah, yeah, the second film. And this, you know, it's one of those things, I don't know the order that the nominations were announced, but this may very well have been their first win historically. I don't even know if that's how they did it.
Who's to say?
Who's to say?
You mentioned previously off pod that this has a Criterion release.
It does.
Did you watch it through Criterion?
I watched the Criterion version. It was actually on YouTube, which was weird. So
okay.
Sorry.
hey, put it on Criterion Collection. We wouldn't have to.
Yeah.
Interesting. I have not seen King of Jazz. In fact, the only nominee of this that I've seen is The Love Parade. Obviously.
Yeah.
With Art Direction, how do you feel with King of Jazz winning from what you've seen?
Okay. So I'm going to be so real with you right now.
Get so real.
King of Jazz is gorgeous.
Yeah.
And the Criterion release that came out, it is, you know, remastered and it's beautiful. It's in color. So it does have that advantage going for it. I think The Love Parade is a beautiful film as well. It has some of those, like the Queen's Palace, the very wide shots and everything. Looks great. But King of Jazz is it's such a funny movie because we kind of picked on Hollywood Review so much, and it is also a review style film, and it doesn't have the same star power that I think Hollywood Review does with all of MGM's players, but this just works so much better.
Interesting.
I highly recommend watching it.
I historically have done a very bad job of storing information on which of Blu-rays I have. I have to check to see if I have King of Jazz on Criterion.
Oh, maybe you do.
I may have all that jazz and not the King of Jazz. I'll have to check.
Man, unrelated.
I'd love to check it out.
Have you seen All That Jazz?
I have not. Oh, man. Bob Fosse.
Dude, I did not expect to cry, and I cried hard.
I am looking forward to watching more and more Criterions as we continue this research into the 1931 and on.
Yeah. You know, I want to take this time to make an announcement, actually.
Yeah.
And this is no big deal, but I'm going to collect all the Best Picture nominees.
My guy.
That's my goal, man.
Let's go.
I just think it'd be so cool.
So you're saying that if there are 10 nominees in 1 year, you're collecting all 10?
Correct.
Copy. Yeah. So you're not just getting the winner?
No, not just the winner. Just anything that's been put out, I want it. And preferably in like its best format. you know.
But we'll do our best to let everyone at home know when Criterion Collection is doing their sales, because a lot of these, not all, and maybe not even the majority, but a lot of these nominees are featured on the Criterion Collection.
Yeah.
So it is worth going to pick that up when you can find it. And yeah, tends to be a little expensive. Blu-ray is about $40, 4K is about $50. But when they have their half-off sale on their website or on Barnes & Noble, very well worth your time to go pick those up. I actually just did that a couple weeks ago and accidentally picked up The Awful Truth for the second time in my life.
You did.
So
you
did. And the second one's now staying at home with you.
And I appreciate it so much.
I got you, Doug.
You sparked my goal right there.
I did, didn't I?
Yeah. I went myself and I got The Great Dictator a couple weeks ago, and you gave me my second one. I was like, well, now I have two. I can't stop here.
Collection grows.
I do want to say, and we talk about this so often, and I don't want to sound like a broken record.
Yeah.
But with what is going on with Warner Brothers right now, being bought by Netflix, or the potential of that, who knows, by the time this episode comes out, what happens. Warner Archive is a huge contributor to these early movies. If you're waiting to buy any of these movies on Criterion, on Warner Media, on whatever, Universal's DVD line, do it sooner than later. Like, if you can afford it, do it now, because who's to say if this is going to be an option in the near future? When Netflix buys Warner Brothers, they're not known for putting out physical media. We've talked about this on our Lost Media episode.
Right.
You can't get Stranger Things season 3, 4.
Or
two,
I'm assuming 5.
Yeah.
You can get 1 and 2.
Can you get 2?
Well, okay. Sorry, let me take that back. You could get 1 and 2. Sure. I don't know if they're still releasing those or manufacturing
those. Yeah. So when Warner Brothers gets picked up, who's to say if any of these movies where, you know, you'll hear us as the episodes go on, like, oh, Cimarron, that's available on blank. This, that, and the other thing, they're available on this. That might start going away.
True.
So there's your call to action.
Pick up your movies. Go see your movies in theaters as well. Yeah. Support the arts.
100%.
That's the message.
Support the theater, support physical media. Down with Netflix.
Down Netflix.
As I watch King of Jazz on YouTube.
As I recommend Jay Kelly a few minutes ago.
Right.
Why don't you take us through Best Actor?
We have, of course, George Arliss in Disraeli.
Who?
I don't know. Never heard of him. He was also in The Green Goddess, which is funny. I got a message from Bryce today that just said, hey, Kyle, The Green Goddess sucked. No, nothing provoked it. Just a message out of the blue.
So Bryce is our boots on the ground, does a movie suck guy. So yeah. Bryce, keep up the good work, my man.
Appreciate you taking one for the team. Or 1,000. Wallace Beery in The Big House.
That was our guy Butch.
Yeah. Maurice Chevalier in The Big Pond and in The Love Parade. Ronald Colman in Bulldog Drummond and Condemned. Mm-hmm. And then Lawrence Tibbett in The Rogue Song. So we've got three here that we're familiar with.
Yep. Big House, Love Parade, and Arliss.
Yep.
In Disraeli.
In Disraeli. And of course, if you've listened to all of our episodes, you know that George Arliss took this one home. I don't like Disraeli. We know this.
The thing that I'll say to keep a level head about it is... level head. is I will say that he needed this win. With how many times he has portrayed this character,
yeah,
to not get this win for his depiction of Disraeli in sound,
yeah,
with sound, probably would have broken him.
It's pretty crazy. He played Disraeli almost as many times as Glenn Close has been nominated for an Oscar.
Oh my God.
Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy. At first I thought you were going to say how many times she's played Cruella de Vil, and I was like, 2?
Bit more than that. I think we both preferred both Wallace Beery and Maurice Chevalier.
Wallace Beery a bit more, but yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with Maurice, and he comes back in a few movies later. We talked about the Lubitsch collection coming to Criterion, so we're going to see him in the next couple years. He's just a lot of fun. I had a blast, but I do agree that Wallace Beery just gave a really, really intense performance.
What was his catchphrase? I'm just kidding.
Who, me?
Who, me?
Yeah.
I'm just joking.
So good.
So good. So let's talk about Best Actress. Best Actress, our nominees were Gloria Swanson in The Trespasser, Norma Shearer in Their Own Desire. We'll get back to that in a second. Greta Garbo in Anna Christie and Romance. Ruth Chatterton in Sarah and Son. Nancy Carroll, The Devil's Holiday. And Norma Shearer, The Divorcee. A question for you, Kyle, before Hello. We get into the winner here.
Yes.
Maurice Chevalier is... Chevalier? Sure.
Yeah.
It was listed as The Big Pawn and the Love Parade. However, I'm seeing Norma Shearer listed as Their Own Desire and then separately as the divorcee. Was there any kind of differentiation there where she wasn't nominated for both but was nominated separately? Nominated, rather.
The information that I found is it has never been established as to why this was, but it possibly could have been because the original report from the Acting Branch Board of Judges only listed the divorcee performance in the results of the nomination voting. So that's more talking about, like, why it won for the divorcee and not the other film. I think that the Academy's still just playing fast and loose at this point, and they're nominating actors for multiple movies and then saying, yes, George Arliss wins, but not for The Green Goddess.
I wonder if maybe it was a studio thing. Like, maybe Maurice, both of his movies were from one studio, so that's why they're able to, like, list the two movies together.
But so is Norma Shearer's. Their Own Desire is also an MGM film.
Oh, well, then it couldn't be that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I imagine there weren't a lot of examples of actors jumping around. I know you can loan out actors and things, but
right,
just to avoid confusion.
So weird.
Yeah.
The reason we bring that up, too, is that it's timely because Norma Shearer does win for The Divorcee as her portrayal as Jerry Martin. Big slow clap from both of us here.
My God.
So good.
She's awesome.
She's also just incredibly adorable.
Yeah.
Beautiful. The second wife. All these things that you can say.
I love her.
So, so, so good.
The interesting thing about this is you have a couple of actors here that were big in silent film.
Right.
So you have Greta Garbo and you have Gloria Swanson. Gloria Swanson has an incredible comeback in 1950. I don't know if you're familiar with a little film called Sunset Boulevard.
You know, I've heard of it.
So good. So good. Can't wait to talk more about that. But, you know, this,
we'll get there.
It's just a big deal, this category. You know, you're seeing... this is kind of sad because it is kind of an example in Sunset Boulevard, but you're seeing kind of these silent film actors and actresses kind of start to fade away from the limelight a little bit. And you have people like Norma Shearer, who also did silent films, of course, but really they have a certain look and they have a certain voice, and that's what's going to keep them moving forward in the industry.
Absolutely.
So
we're down to our last two nominations.
So we have Best Directing. That's for Clarence Brown for Anna Christie and Romance, both MGM films. Robert Leonard for The Divorcee. Ernst Lubitsch for The Love Parade. Louis Milestone for All Quiet on the Western Front. And King Vidor for Hallelujah. And of course, our boy.
Starting the sweep.
Who I think is one of my favorite directors at this point. Louis Milestone took home the win. Two Arabian Nights from the first Academy Awards, which I have not seen yet. The Racket.
I was about to say, you'll get there.
Yeah, I almost forgot. What was it the previous? Did he have one the previous year? I don't think he did.
No.
Okay. And then All Quiet on the Western Front this year. And he does a ton of other stuff in the future. He's making movies until 1960.
Well, this solidifies him, right?
Like 100%.
Obviously, this doesn't put him on the map altogether, but this movie and this win specifically is going to just completely change his trajectory.
Yeah. This is his second win for Best Directing.
Yep.
Two? This is the first guy
to
win two Best Directing Oscars. And it's just so well-deserved. All Quiet on the Western Front is so incredible. We've praised it for an entire episode. We've praised it multiple times for the ceremony episode. We're going to praise it again with Antonio Carlotta in just a few moments.
Yes.
It's just a wonderful movie.
Well, and it goes even further than that when you look at, you know, he has won Best Director before, but he hasn't won Best Directing and Best Picture before. I think it says something completely different when you can have both of those things be true, because that direction leads to the film and its status.
Right.
So, something he did not have with The Racket previously, worth noting.
For the and Two Arabian Nights.
Correct.
Yeah. Which actually brings us to solidifying his great achievement of winning both.
In Outstanding Production. The nominees were The Love Parade by Ernst Lubitsch, Paramount, famous Lasky, The Divorcee, Robert Z. Leonard, for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM. Disraeli, Jack L. Warner, and Daryl F. Zanuck for Warner Brothers.
R.I.P.
Hopefully not. Yeah. The Big House, Irving Thalberg for Cosmopolitan. Love their magazines. And All Quiet on the Western Front, Carl Laemmle for Universal Studios.
This is going to be such a good segue. Who won?
So the winner of this was All Quiet on the Western Front, Carl Laemmle for Universal Studios. So this is what I mean when I say that Louis Milestone now has Best Direction and Outstanding Production under his belt.
Yeah.
For one film.
What else is there to say about All Quiet?
It's honestly surprising that there's only two.
Yeah.
Only two wins for All Quiet on the Western Front. Not to say that anyone who did win was not deserving of mm-hmm. that, but it's just that this movie is a behemoth, and to this day is still that behemoth. And we mentioned this in our interview with Antonia, but specifically, this movie is still cited today.
Yeah.
People are still watching this movie to figure out how to make their movie and how to get ideas. Mm-hmm. So it's surprising that there's only two there, but obviously these are the, not to say that one's better than the other, but two of the most prestigious of the awards.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that's interesting about this, and it's probably sparked by our conversation with Antonia,
sure,
is you mentioned the producers of these film, and for a lot of them, they are studio heads at this point. So you mentioned the head of Warner Brothers, literally the Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. And then in the Big House for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, that was Irving Thalberg was the producer there?
Correct.
I don't know if he is...
Sorry, for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer?
Mm.
Robert Z. Leonard.
Okay, Leonard. Thalberg was
Cosmopolitan.
Gotcha, okay. All of these giant studios have these names that are very recognizable. And if someone here isn't recognizable right away, like the head of MGM, big name, but you think about Louis B. Mayer. Like, you know the Warner Brothers. Irving Thalberg has an Academy Award named after him at this point. Carl Laemmle, and we talk about this with Antonia, it's not a name that a lot of people know.
Which is unfortunate because of all the work that he did.
I'm excited for you all to hear the interview in just a few moments. So I'll save all of that. But I think it's very fascinating to think about the studios and like the big wins for these studios. And this was a huge year for Universal, who was not one of the big five studios at this time. They were one of the little three, if you will. And this was the first year they had any nominations, and they took home three Oscars. That's a big deal.
It is.
It had the two for All Quiet and then the one for Art Direction and King of Jazz. I love Universal.
Yeah. This put them on the map for sure, for certain.
Yeah.
For something that is a presence that they will have for a very long time at the Academy Awards. It's also worth noting that there are only two movies listed this year that have multiple wins. That was The Big House, and The Big House specifically had Best Writing and Best Sound Recording, and then All Quiet on the Western Front, which of course, as we mentioned, did take home Best Directing and Outstanding Production. Otherwise, pretty split wash. Mm-hmm. We had Disraeli picked up a win, Love Parade picked up a win, those two other films that we haven't seen.
Yeah.
The Big House.
Mm-hmm. And the documentary.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. That would be the documentary being with Bird at the South Pole.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's the Academy Awards. This was a big year because this was, I think the awards themselves took place like a week after the stock market crashed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that was all kind of looming in the background a little bit. And a lot of these movies that won and were released, I talk about the importance of these studios. This was a big deal for them. This was a time where they were making or breaking in a big way, which is, again, a huge reason Universal needed this win, being one of the smaller studios, quote unquote. Highlights of this is the first year you had the Best Sound category.
It will stay with us.
For a long time?
Well, a very large part of this is we've talked about the studio interaction to all of this. We've talked about how the studios play a significant part of this and how these award recognitions can lend themselves to notoriety. And one big part of that is Universal and Universal Pictures and what they became. And it's a very exciting time for us to then talk about the interview that we had with Antonia, where she breaks down the actual history of the Universal Studio.
Yeah. So we're going to jump right over to that now. So enjoy our interview with Antonia Carlotta.
We'll see you at the end.
And then, okay. So I'm really excited to have a very special guest with us today.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Yeah. Welcome back. No, we have with us Antonia Carlotta.
Hi, I'm Antonia. I am the great grandniece of Carl Laemmle, the founder of Universal.
Yeah.
And to make it a little bit easier, he is my great-grandfather's uncle, or my great-great-grandfather's brother.
Got it.
Amazing. Incredible. Antonia, you have a YouTube channel and a Patreon right now where I've seen you talk a lot about the history of Universal Studios as the film production company and kind of the founding and Carl Laemmle and his son, Jr., their establishment of the studio. How long have you been doing that?
I have had my channel. So my channel is called Universally Me, It's all about the history of Universal. It's about my Lemley family. And I dive a lot into the Universal monsters in particular. I have had this channel now for probably about 10 years, maybe even a bit more. But as I think many longstanding YouTube channels are, I've had some years on and some years off. Some years I'm in school, some years I'm working. But for the last 2 or 3 years, I've been really diving in and really consistent on the channel, and it's going really well, which is fun.
Yeah, I first found you on TikTok and I was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. This person and their connection to the studio. And then I went to your YouTube channel and the amount of information you have just across videos, this whole is really incredible. You have quite a bit on just the studio in general. And like you said, a lot about the Universal monsters. The one video I really enjoyed so far is the actor that plays Renfield in Dracula. You did like a deep dive of his life. So fascinating and so much information I had no idea about.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, what's really fun for me about the channel is now I'm becoming something of an expert on the topic, but for so much of my channel, it's me learning along with everybody else. I'm sort of discovering my own family history, and I'm just learning about the work that they're doing. And interestingly enough, I feel like my audience and the people in my comments are often even bigger experts than I am. So that's been very cool, kind of in my making videos, in my community building, and just in learning about all of this in general.
A question that I have is kind of a chicken or the egg situation. Given your history and your passion for movies, which one came first? Did you learn of the history of your family and then that brought in the passion, or was it kind of a funny happenstance?
I think it's been a little bit of both. I lived in Connecticut until I was 13 years old. So while I had a little sense that my family had been involved in movies somehow in the past, it didn't really mean anything to me as a kid. But when I was a kid, I did used to host movie nights at my house, and in particular, scary movie nights at my house. So a little bit of that interest was there without understanding how it related to me. Once I moved to California, now Universal City is, you know, in my backyard, and Lemley theaters are around me, and I'm actually seeing the industry in real life all around me. That just lit a fire, you know, under me. Then I was so passionate, and now I had like reasons for it.
Man, it's so incredible too. I know you just you were on a show, a documentary special about the Epic Universe. I watched that, and that was so cool too. I don't want to say they allowed the opportunity to talk about the origins of the studio, but seeing you talk and like, you know, emphasize how important your family was to the creation of this studio that really is like the powerhouse studio today. I mean, it's one of the oldest studios still around.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's only really in competition with Paramount, I would say, these days. I do know Gaumont, I think, still exists in France, but I couldn't tell you that I'm an expert on that one.
Sure.
But yeah, and Universal was technically, like, at the time of the awards we'll be talking about, they were one of the little three studios. They weren't seen as a powerhouse at the time.
Right.
But they have just, you know, they were scrappy and they always made it work. And now they truly are one of the powerhouse studios.
It's so cool, especially with everything going on right now with Warner Brothers. It just kind of emphasizes even more so how incredible the legacy of Universal is.
Did something happen with Warner?
Oh, you didn't hear?
I wasn't familiar. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Did you hear about the, what did they call it? A hostile bid that got made today?
Yes.
Yeah, hostile bid from Paramount, right?
Yes.
Yeah, David Ellis.
Now I kind of hope that Universal throws their hat in the ring.
That would be interesting.
I mean, at this point, why not, right? Let's make it a free-for-all.
Yeah.
Like, we had three bidders, and then Netflix was the first, and then Paramount says, hey, hostile bidding. Just throw Universal in there.
Why not?
Why not?
Yeah. Anything's better than Netflix at this point.
I would agree.
So, Carl Lemley, I know Universal started in 1915, and then it wasn't really until Carl Lemley, like, started taking risks, if I understand correctly, that they kind of blew up into the studio.
Yeah, you know, Carl Lemley's trajectory is really it's a slow build. It's the snowball getting momentum that starts, you know, he was a German immigrant that moved to the U.S. As a teenager, no idea what he wanted to do. He just knew he wanted to kind of be here and be a part of it all. He lived in New York and Chicago. He worked on a farm and a pharmacy. He managed a clothing store in Oshkosh, Wisconsin for 11 years. And it's when he kind of spontaneously quits that he realizes he wants a career, not just a job. And he's trying to figure out what that is. And he sees his very first theater. And he sees the line of people waiting outside. He goes in himself. He watches movies like all day long. And he just is instantly obsessed with this idea that he's going to own a theater. So he finds a little spot. He opens his first theater. It was called The White Front. This is 1906. Does so well that in just a few months, he's able to open up another theater. Then at the time, there was really no quality control over the prints that you were getting to your theater. You might get the same one as the guy next door. You might get the same one you had last week or an old one that's falling apart. So he gets into distribution. He starts the Lemley Film Service so that he can control the quality of prints coming to his theaters and, you know, be the distributor for everybody else. And then there just really aren't enough movies to go around. We're still that early in the industry. So he decides to start producing films. So this is about 1908, 1909. He starts the Independent Moving Pictures Company. Now, the big kahuna running the show at the time was Thomas Edison. He had patents to parts of projectors and cameras and everything that you needed to show or make a movie. And if you wanted to make one, you had to pay these exorbitant fees to be a part of it all. And Uncle Carl kind of thought that was very unfair. It was keeping the industry down. So he fights Edison and goes independent. Edison sues Uncle Carl 289 times. It was a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in the midst of this, in order to kind of consolidate power and be able to continue fighting Edison, Carl Lemley merges his Independent Moving Pictures Company with a handful of other companies to create Universal in 1912. And at the time, that is in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which was kind of the center of the film industry at the time. Now, in order to get kind of physical distance between Edison and Uncle Carl's businesses, because Edison would send in his guys, like not only was he suing and coming after your business, but he would also just destroy your equipment if you were not using Edison's equipment. He would, you know, just destroy everything that you had worked for. So for a little while, Uncle Carl moved his productions down to Cuba, and he had a few production teams making movies down there. And then 1915, they come out to California, and that's when he opens up Universal City. Wow. That was a very long answer to a very easy breezy question, but
no, it's an amazing story, honestly.
Yeah, it's so cool to just be like, yeah, I don't know what I want to do, and then you're like the creator of one of the biggest studios in history.
Yeah,
is insane.
He thought he was just going to open up like a five and dime store. That was really the idea, and so he was just trying to find a storefront to open up this five and dime shop when he sees that first theater. So it's crazy how quickly he pivoted. And to your point, really took risks every step of the way. It was a risk to invest his entire life savings into this storefront, opening up a theater, a risk to move into distribution, to fight Thomas Edison, to move to California, where there were a couple studios and, you know, some people were, but the industry was not focused out here yet. Mm-hmm. And all of those things were risks. And Universal City itself was also a big risk. The location that it's in right now at the time was seen as like worlds away from, you know, sort of LA where the studios did already exist. He decided he wasn't just making a studio, but an entire movie making city. So he had a hospital, a zoo, a school, its own police force and fire department, everything that a city needed to run. It also had its own like local, you know, mayor, can't think of the word, like politics. Mm-hmm. And people really lived on the Universal backlot as well. So like my Aunt Carla grew up living in a bungalow at Universal. So all of those things were really risky. People thought he was crazy.
Mayor of Universal City sounds like a pretty good gig.
That's so cool.
Something I would love to take.
The very first mayor was Lois Weber, actually. She was a really big female director back in the day. and she was voted the first mayor. And the first police chief was also a woman, which I love. Her name was Laura Oakley.
Wow. That's really
cool. It's great seeing that. It's great to see that on two counts. One, the progressive nature back then, right? But also, one thing I wanted to point out was, just comment on, it's always really inspiring when you hear that the way that something was formed stemmed from someone being such a big fan, right? Like watching the movies and watching the numbers and like the box office. I mean, that's what we do. So it's very cool to hear someone who's as invested as we are is someone who started this and not just someone who wanted to get rich quick, you know?
No, absolutely. And there's one biography of Carl Laemmle that exists right now. I've been slowly working on my own modern biography of him. The original one was written in 1930 by John Drinkwater. He actually talks about in Carl's early days before he had made it, when he's just running, you know, newspaper routes and trying to pull a penny together. One of his favorite activities was going to local plays or the opera. Like, he was really into the arts, and I think he even put on a couple of his own shows a few times. So he came into the industry as a fan.
That's awesome. When was it that he shifted the company down to Carl Laemmle Jr.?
That was right about 1929 or so. Okay. So it was when 1929, 1930. So All Quiet on the Western Front was one of Jr.'s first big films. And it was an incredible movie because it helped kind of legitimize Universal. Again, they were seen as a smaller studio, a little more scrappy. They were known a lot for their Westerns, their family comedies. All Quiet was a big film for the studio in that way. But it also kind of showed that Junior was going to be able to contend with the other big studio heads and that he was an artist, not just a Nepo baby.
Yeah, it's really wild. We've covered the first two Academy years so far. And this year is the first time that Universal has received any Oscar nominations. It had the ones for All Quiet and then also King of Jazz. And it's wild how this is the first time they receive those nominations. And All Quiet on the Western Front really is the most impressive film that we've watched that was nominated for Best Picture so far. To say that that is the responsibility of Carl Laemmle Jr., who I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, he was 21 at the time of taking over Universal.
Yeah.
That is wild. What a success story that is.
Well, and we've talked about it before on the podcast, but it's just, it's kind of, I don't even know the word for it. It's kind of shocking watching the quality difference of All Quiet on the Western Front compared to other nominees like Disraeli, and not even to a point of, you know, enjoyment, but the quality of the film, the quality of the audio is just a completely different nature. And it really is. I think we've said it on a previous podcast. If not, we've said it often. We'll say it on this one. It really is the first great nominee that you see in terms of like, this is a masterclass. And people are still studying that movie today to understand how to film it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, Junior Laemmle definitely marked a shift in the types of movies that Universal was making when Uncle Carl, his dad, was running the show. He had a preference for the most part of churning out as many movies per year as possible, kind of on a small budget, low risk, low reward. But, you know, Junior comes in. He says he wants to make fewer movies every year and he wants to spend much more on them. He wanted to make those prestige projects and he wanted to be able to contend.
Man, and boy, did he, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Seriously,
it's so crazy.
Absolutely.
I just watched, I think I only made it halfway through before we started recording, a little bit of King of Jazz. And even that is just such an incredible film. It's beautifully shot. They're doing stuff in that, I mean, we haven't seen on any of the other nominees. And just the quality of Universal Pictures from that point on is astonishing, really. When was the first time you remember seeing All Quiet on the Western Front?
Probably. So I watched clips of it for many years before I finally sat down and watched the whole movie all the way through. I think it probably was only about 7 years ago or so that I watched the entire movie all the way through. And I remember being absolutely blown away. I think sometimes too, in that pre-code era, it still shocks me how modern films can feel and how much they push the boundaries. I never would have expected the violence in the movie, how sort of blunt and in your face and how heavy a watch it is. I just never would have expected that from a film from that era, as well as, you know, just even some of the sexuality in the film and some of the other things that get touched upon, it all really surprised me in this amazing way.
Well, it's interesting because at the time, and you mentioned pre-code, this is a big part of it, but we've seen war, especially in the first year, the 1928s, there was a 28. In 1928, with the ceremony, every movie that was there had somehow touched on the war, right? Wings, Seventh Heaven, The Racket. But the way that All Quiet touched on it was much more of an anti-war message, which is not something that you saw at the time. So was this something that was truly, like, what was the pushback on this kind of movie and that kind of message of anti-war in a time where that was really seen as radical?
Yeah, you know, internationally, in particular, particularly in Europe, it didn't go over well at all. You know, Carl Laemmle Sr., like I said, he was a German immigrant. He was proudly American, but he was still proudly German his whole life. He used to go back to Germany as much as possible. He would send money back to his hometown of Laupheim whenever he could. His German heritage was very important to him. And in making All Quiet, I think that he hoped that it would really, I think he hoped it would send something of a pacifist message, and that it would help people not just see Germans from, you know, World War One as enemies or as terrible people, but as, you know, it could be anybody who gets wrapped up in the war or in fighting for their homeland or whatever that means. I think he was really just hoping to bring light to the horrors of war. When the movie came out, by this time, Hitler and the Nazi regime is coming to power in Germany. And so they see this film as a movie that's making them look weak. And it actually gets banned. They destroy a lot of screenings in Germany. They release rats in the movie screenings and stink bombs. And then they outright banned it. And I know it was banned in like Italy and Bulgaria. I'm not sure why, but I think New Zealand banned it as well, and a handful of other countries. So despite the really good message and the message that I know meant a lot to Uncle Carl and to Junior, it was not received well everywhere.
Man, and that just adds to the risk itself. Like there's obviously the risk of putting that much money into a film when, like you said, they've been doing smaller pictures for smaller returns. To choose a movie with that strong of a message as well is so brave, and the way it paid off, because again, I cannot express myself enough at how excellent this movie is.
And, you know, I'll also just add one more thing. This was very early in the Great Depression. So spending so much money on a film that's so risky, right? All of these things, it just amplifies the risk even further.
Yeah, it seems like Universal was kind of, if this didn't work, it would have been pretty detrimental for the studio.
There are a lot of times when the studio is they're right on the brink of losing the studio. And that, you know, finally tips in 1936 with Showboat. Mm-hmm. That is when my family was forced to sell the studio. But they, you know, they took risks for many years that always paid off. Even Showboat paid off. They just didn't have time to see it through.
Right, right. And I do want to, like, we're mostly talking about All Quiet, but I do want to talk about what came after that, because that's some of my personal favorite Universal properties are the Universal monsters. And so much of that is in thanks to Carl Laemmle Jr. You do so many videos of just what inspired Dracula and Frankenstein and all of this. Can you tell us a little bit about the creation of those properties?
Yeah, so Jr. had a fascination with darkness and the macabre since he was a kid. I think that it aligns pretty well. And actually, the author, Julian David Stone, who I really love, has brought this up before, that it aligns really well with when his mom passed away very suddenly at 11 years old of the Spanish flu. And so I think that Junior spent a lot of time grappling with life and death and what it all means and being reunited with lost loved ones. So when he turns 21, he takes over control of Universal, and he wants to kind of bring these darker stories to life. He does think that other people his age are going to relate to them, that these movies can be beautiful and mean something. And he just thinks it's worth investing in. And even his dad, who, again, has always been something of a risk taker, is not so sure. All scary movies to come before this pretty much have had what's kind of known as the Scooby-Doo ending, right? Yeah. You might be in a haunted house, but at the end, it's just somebody messing with everybody. Junior now wants to make these supernatural films, Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy. And despite everybody thinking he's insane, he pushes ahead with them. So Dracula is the very first one, a huge success. People love it. So he goes right into making Frankenstein. Again, even his dad thinks that Dracula may have just been a fluke. He doesn't want him to make any more scary movies, but Junior pushes ahead. And Frankenstein, The Mummy, The Invisible Man, even The Werewolf of London, Bride of Frankenstein, they're all huge hits for Universal.
Probably the biggest properties of Universal. And that's what's so fascinating. This is a studio that is over 100 years old at this point, and its most impactful characters were kind of right at the inception of the studio, and they've just lived on forever. I mentioned that I watched that documentary about Epic Universe, and just the Dark Universe segment of that park is by far my favorite part. We both went just a few months ago and checked it out for the first time.
Like 2 days separate.
Yeah.
We went separately, but... Yeah, like we traveled individually, and I was there on like went Thursday, and you were there on like a Saturday.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. My question for
you. Like you missed the boat on planning that a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, we're good at podcasting, not so much planning. My question for you, though, is, you know, with your big connection and your passion for Universal, let alone the Universal Monsters, have you had a chance to ride Monsters Unchained?
Yes. So because I was in this Epic Ride documentary, which was a dream come true on Peacock, and I do hope everybody watches it, they flew me out for the opening of Epic Ride, and they actually did a little bit of filming with me in the park. So I got to, or sorry, of Epic Universe. So I got to be, I did some filming in the park. I was there for the opening day and for the media day before the opening day, and I got to ride. I think I must have ridden Monsters Unchained like 5 different times.
It's so good.
And I just thought it was absolutely incredible. I just think there are many years where I have felt that even though the monsters are enduring characters in the hearts of fans of us, that they haven't always gotten the respect that they deserve from the studio. And even at times that the studio is maybe trying to distance from them a little bit. I don't know why, and I've never quite understood it. And with the Dark Universe, it feels like finally they're embracing it and they see that we're all out there. And I think that they made this incredible land. Like, I really felt like I was transported to this, you know, German village in the 1819 whatevers. And seeing Frankenstein's castle and riding Monsters Unchained and seeing all the monsters alive, like, that was just an incredibly unreal feeling. And I also can't help but like love and connect to the story they made about Victoria Frankenstein trying to carry on her family's legacy. I kept trying to make jokes that maybe they were inspired by me.
Yeah, that's really cool.
They didn't really acknowledge that, but I think it's me.
We can choose to believe.
That's what I'll believe, yeah.
One of my final notes is just, you know, I know it was emotional for me, so I can only imagine, and I'd love to hear how emotional it was for you. You talk about how there kind of still is a time, where it feels like these characters aren't held in the regard that they really should be. And then you enter that world of Dark Universe and you ride that ride, which is incredible and probably the best ride there for my opinion. But then you see the gift shops and you see like the merchandise that you can get, and you can wear the bride hat. You can wear like, you know, Lon Chaney Jr.'s sweatshirt from Wolfman. What did that mean to you to kind of see like them get their like moment in the sun?
It just really feels, I don't even know how to word it. It just feels like it's time, and it feels so fulfilling. And I spent, you know, I think part of the impetus for me even starting Universally Me to begin with was learning about all of the amazing things that Uncle Carl in particular, but my family did, and realizing that most of the world has never heard of him. They don't know the name Carl Laemmle. And even a lot of his work, no matter how amazing it is, like, people don't remember it. And seeing the, you know, their work, their monsters in these stores, seeing the movies that they made becoming rides and stores and attractions, it just really felt like maybe they are being remembered the way that they should. I'm not sure why. I can't think of a more eloquent way to say that right now, but it feels like very fulfilling on their behalf.
No, perfect. I was really excited to see that you were part of Epic Ride and that they were actually acknowledging like the importance that, that your family has on that studio. And there's a big part of me that's hoping that they'll kind of dive into that more and look back at their legacy even moving forward. And not just at the theme park, but the history of the studio in general, because it really is your family that provided the studio so much, and they would not have made it nearly as far as they have without that.
Yeah, you know, I think often about how Disney has managed to make Walt Disney this very mythical character in their parks. And I feel like there's such an opportunity to do the same with Uncle Carl and Junior. You know, Uncle Carl in particular, nobody has a bad word to say about him. You know, this is a time when most studio heads were angry and slimy and, you know, not fantastic people. And Carl Laemmle, across the board, thank goodness, was like the best person on earth. And I've already talked about so many of his accomplishments. And one big one that I actually think connects to All Quiet that we haven't even touched on is he also saved hundreds of Jewish refugees by in the 1930s, as the Nazi regime was coming to power. Wow. Uncle Carl would sign affidavits to bring them to the United States, and he would set them up with homes and jobs, many of them at Universal, but anywhere that he could find them. And so he brought over more than 300 Jewish families in the 1930s.
Wow, that's incredible.
Again, you talk about the people who are able to do this, and it's great to hear there's people with like hearts and passion for this and for other people.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so I hope that Universal does continue to find ways to weave his work and that history into the park, because there's no reason that he shouldn't be featured more and remembered more. And I think there are a lot of, you know, it's a studio, it's a park about movies. There are so many ways you can incorporate a character like that into all aspects of the park.
Yes. Absolutely. I'd love to see more incorporation.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. I did see a video where you talked about the remake of All Quiet on the Western Front a little bit. Obviously, that's very far removed from any connection your family had. But it was interesting that you brought up how kind of brutal that version of the film was. How do you feel about the original version and kind of its pacing and its tone in comparison?
I think that there was really, I think, just one big thing that was missing for me in the new film versus the old film, because both are brutal and both are really hard and really real. But the original film had moments of levity or moments of space from the horror that allowed you to process what was going on. And the new film, though I'm sure maybe it is more real, just laid it on over and over and over again. And just when you thought you might get a second, they introduce tanks or, you know, they kill somebody new. And that made it just extra hard to watch and to connect to. It's a movie I watched once and will never watch again.
Yes.
I will say the musical score, I do remember loving. Again, it made everything more powerful. Mm. But it almost felt a little too much in a way that then it might miss the message. You know, when you're in maybe the horror space, you might call it torture porn. And this felt like torture porn to me.
Sure.
Versus the original film that I thought was getting the message across a little more and allowing the audience to be there with the film.
Sure. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think the kind of ups and downs that the original has really, it's able to drive the message in a little bit harder than just kind of beating you down over and over and over again.
Well, that, and also, you know, with the Wings of it all, like Wings had existed 2 years prior to that point. So it kind of matched the tone of Wings a little bit in the first third to kind of like lull you into that false sense of security. And then it really starts laying on thick of like, there really is no out of this. Like there is no escape. So I thought that was a really interesting and honestly felt very intentional choice. It's not a movie of confused tones, but it's intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I will say one of the most powerful moments of the original All Quiet for me is when he goes home when he's on his furlough and he meets with the professor and the class, that professor who had been hyping everybody up to go to war. There's no greater glory than, you know, fighting for your country. And he goes back and says, when it comes to dying for your country, it's better not to die at all. And just talking about, you know, you talk here like you know what's going on. You have no idea what's going on. We're in it every day. We're seeing our friends die in front of us. Like, this is senseless. And I think that is one of the most powerful speeches in all of movie history, like right up there with Charlie Chaplin and The Great Dictator.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. So sorry.
Hi, welcome back.
I thought you guys were just being dramatic about the time limit. I didn't know it was actually going to kick me out.
No, it's Zoom is pretty fickle about that, but promise it wasn't us.
Yeah, we weren't like, well, that we're does done. It. Bye.
That's enough. We got what we need.
No. I had one question, and this is kind of just more of a vain thing. You don't even need to put this in. Hopefully you do. You mentioned that you would listen to the 1929 episode that we covered about the ceremony, and the first half of that. I'm wondering if you had a chance to watch the Broadway review, or sorry, the Hollywood review of 1929.
Maybe. Because I get really confused between like the Broadway review of blah, 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 the Hollywood review, Broadway Melody. So I'm not sure. There's one of those my Aunt Carla dances in and comes out of like an oyster shell or a clam shell.
That sounds like it might be the Hollywood review of 1929.
Yeah, I think that's the Hollywood review.
I have watched it. Yes.
Amazing.
That's so cool.
That's the name of it. And I thought that was such an interesting thing because the way that they talk about that is in the same way of like the monsters of like, you know, that Lon Chaney, not Lon Chaney Jr., had portrayed.
I know Lon Chaney Jr. was eventually the Wolfman. Did he do a lot with the Universal Monsters?
Yeah. So Lon Chaney Sr. was the Hunchback of Notre Dame in 1923 and Phantom of the Opera in 1925. And then he did a handful of other Universal films in particular. He, right before he passed, was with MGM for a couple of years. Mm. But the sort of common thought is that had he not passed away, he would have played Dracula in Dracula in 1931. Gotcha. Then because he and Todd Browning had a big history of working together. So Browning wanted him, I think, for Freaks. Browning wanted him for Dracula. There's a handful of movies that came out in those years that Lon Chaney was the front runner for. And then he passed away, so he didn't get to do them.
Wow.
Hard to imagine a scenario where Bela Lugosi is not Dracula.
Yeah.
I've done whole videos about, you know, how Dracula would differ had Lon Chaney played him instead of Bela Lugosi and how that might have changed the entire trajectory of the Universal Monsters.
Wow.
Like we can maybe get a sense of Lon Chaney's vampire because he did London After Midnight with Todd Browning and we've seen the scary like top hat, pointy teeth guy. You know, that's kind of his vampire. And he did so many physical transformations. Where Bela Lugosi, who is much more proud of, you know, himself and his work, he didn't change a whole lot about himself. And he was so much more charming versus scary. He brought you in instead of pushing you away. So I think all of the monsters would be different. And if he played Dracula, might he have played Frankenstein? And what does that mean for Bela and Boris and all of the monster actors that came after?
Yeah. Wow. That would have changed everything. The Grinch never would have maybe had Boris Karloff. Who knows?
Right?
Dang, I want that. I want that real bad.
Yeah. What a weird
thing. Sorry, that was the whole tangent.
No.
We love those here. So good. That's okay.
Academy Awards of 1930.
It's so good. I guess if we could talk on King of Jazz for like 2 seconds. Have you seen that film?
I have seen it. I wish I should have watched it right before this, but I have seen it. I actually got to see it with my Aunt Carla once, who also dances in the King of Jazz.
Wow. That's so cool. Yeah, I said, I haven't finished it yet. So now I'm going to be like eagle-eyed, like just looking. And whoever looks the most like you, I'm going to be like, that's her.
She is in, there's sort of an international dance at the end of all sorts of dances from all different countries. And she's one of those featured dancers.
Gotcha.
And I'm trying to remember if she might also be in the, what they call like the Rhapsody in Blue, the piano scene.
Yes.
That's blue. She may also be featured in there somewhere.
That's so amazing.
I remember I loved The King of Jazz. I thought it was a lot of fun. I don't think it did well at the time because it cost a ton of money. Mm. Kind of like I just alluded to, there were a lot of these reviews and musicals coming out around that time. So this got a little lost in the jumble. But, you know, now looking back on it, they did a really great restoration in the last like 5 or 10 years, I think. And it's gaining popularity. It's a lot of fun. Definitely some scenes and takes that wouldn't go over well if they were made today, though.
Sure. It's interesting because Ryan brought up the Hollywood Review a second ago. And when we covered that movie, we were, I don't want to say we were bashing it, but the idea of it was so unique and something we hadn't seen before.
Right.
And I had not heard of King of Jazz until we started doing the podcast. And I saw you had done a video on it. And I was like, well, let me check it out before we get to speak with you. And I was amazed to see it followed a similar format. But it's so much better than the Hollywood Review. All of the performances and everything, the segments are just, they're shot better. I think the costumes are better. They're all choreographed. It's all very impressive. And I think it does help that it had that restoration and color and everything. But it's a beautiful movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I got to see it, I got to see it on a big screen, which is very, nice. I feel very fortunate living in LA. And I'm not actually, you guys must be East Coast.
Yes, we're in Georgia, Atlanta.
Okay. I feel very fortunate in LA that classic films are screening here all the time. And when movies do get new restorations, some theater's going to put it up on the big screen. So getting to see it with my Aunt Carla on a big screen was a very special way to get to see a movie like that.
Yeah, that must have been a tremendous experience. So cool.
I would love to do something like that. I wish we had more opportunities like that in Atlanta, but I mean, the best thing that we've had recently is, I know Kyle went to, a showing of Wings not too long ago, a couple months ago, actually.
Yeah, much smaller at a very small private theater. But we're always promoting like events like that and things, seeing old movies in theaters.
Are there a lot of classic theaters or like old theaters in Georgia?
I think the oldest theater is the Plaza Theater in Atlanta. Yes. And they do operate as an independent theater. They'll show a lot of classics. I think earlier this year they did the Gold Diggers of, is it 1936? Or 33, I think it is. But they're always doing classic films or you know, independent films, classics.
That's cool. As you guys keep going, you should do screenings of films at that theater and then live record your podcast in the theater.
What it is a an dream. Incredible idea.
we would love
to see that happen. Yeah. One biggest thing for me with the Plaza, I've hosted a screening there before for something I've worked for previously, but you mentioned the older movies they're playing. This weekend, actually, December 12th, they're playing Gremlins and Gremlins 2, which I can't imagine a better double feature for me. Yeah. But still, we want to see like the older classics. You know, part of the reason we do this podcast is to talk about the restoration of film and like, you know, preservation of the ideas and the history. So the history that you've brought us today of Universal and how it led us to All Quiet on the Western Front has just been amazing.
Thank you. No, I appreciate you guys having me on so much. And I think this podcast concept and topic is so cool. I feel like such a wealth of knowledge in a very narrow space and sort of a complete black void in all of the, like when you guys reached out and talked about, you know, All Quiet winning the Oscar that year, of course I know that. And all the other films, I was like, you know, I don't even know if I've seen, I have seen The Big House, but otherwise I hadn't seen any of the other films nominated for Best Picture that year. And so now like I'm excited to listen to your podcast every time so that I can get, you know, sort of the inside info on all of these different movies.
Really appreciate you saying that.
And if you have the chance from this year, The Divorcee was fantastic. And I loved seeing that. We talked about how, was it The Divorcee or The Love Parade?
Mm-hmm.
The Love Parade kind of started the idea of like a more raunchy comedy that we see these days. And that wouldn't have existed without something like The Love Parade. So those two movies are the ones that stand out the most to me. You can also see Disraeli. but we think that those two, I would say those two, Love Parade and Divorcee, were like the standouts just underneath the majesty of All Quiet.
All right. Yeah. And The Divorcee, that was Norma Shearer, right?
Yeah. You got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You did mention us doing a live episode at the Plaza Theater. Have you done anything like that in the past?
No.
No? You should do the same.
I'm just saying you guys should do it. That idea scares me, terrifies me.
Oh, I think
me.
It would be so cool.
But if we do it, let's say like our 10th that we end up doing, we should have you out for a Universal one to talk about Universal.
Sure. Yeah, I'm in.
There you go.
I'll
That'd
do
be
it.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, obviously Universal has been nominated countless times at this point. You said 1936, though, with Showboat is when the Lemleys let go of the studio. So I don't know how many times they were nominated from 30 to 36. I don't expect you to be on every episode that happens, but if one pops up, I would love to have you on again.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. Please don't hesitate to reach out or anything. And honestly, if it's a year after and you feel like you want to have me back, like I'll do my research. I'll come prepared.
That would be fantastic.
We'd love that.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I don't just say this to like, because you're on the show or whatever, but I love Universal Studios and I have for so long. I grew up in Orlando, Florida. I spent so much time at Universal Studios and Disney as well, but I always had a huge love for the Universal parks, probably because of all the movies that the rides were based on. And, you know, a lot of that is Steven Spielberg's not fault, but you know what I mean.
So, doing.
Yeah,
his doing. So just when I found your channel and, you know, I really did start as a fan. I was like, oh, this is so fascinating. This is so interesting. And I will continue to be excited for every video you put out.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we're so grateful that you agreed to come on to the show.
I would love for you to let us know and let the audience know where we can reach you and where we can check out your content.
Yeah, so my YouTube channel is called Universally Me, or you could just look up my name, Antonia Carlotta. I put out videos every week about the history of Universal, the classic monsters. Pretty soon, let's see, my next video is going to be about the grueling process that Boris Karloff had to go through in creating the Frankenstein monster. It was hours every day. He had back problems and scars the rest of his life from that. I also have a video coming up about the opening of Universal City, which in itself was exciting and disastrous at the same time. And you can also find me on Instagram, TikTok, Patreon, literally anything. Just look up Antonia Carlotta.
That's awesome.
I'm pumped to watch this.
Yeah, I'm going to have all of that in the show notes and stuff. And yeah, Antonia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Of course. Thank you.
It's really been a treat.
Well, thank you guys so much.
What a cool interview, right?
I mean, it's last, you know, this episode's kind of sandwiched between, I shouldn't say sandwich. It follows the conversation that we had with Jordan, my buddy Jordan, to talk about All Quiet on the Western Front. So to have, you know, not just one guest this season, but and this year especially, but two. And two of the caliber that we had, specifically to have Antonia speak to her family legacy and Universal and where that's led to now. I mean, we talked significantly about the Universal Monsters, which is just, you know, part of me was trying not to like fanboy out and like go grab my collection of Universal Monsters and right. Be like, can you just look at it? Like, maybe that's as good as like you signing it. I don't know.
It's so cool. I just had a blast talking to her. It was so cool. I hope we get her on again in the future.
Yeah, please do make sure to make note to go watch her videos. I know, yeah. Kyle was, it's on my docket to watch tonight. Mentioned the Epic Ride documentary on Peacock that she was featured in.
Yeah, if you're a fan of the Universal Studio theme parks, that's a great three-part documentary. She speaks about the legacy of the studio and her family in the first episode, and then she has a little segment in the third episode kind of talking about where the parks are now and more of that legacy. But yeah, check out her YouTube channel as well. All of her videos are fascinating. She talks about like the actors, the very small actors in some of these Universal Monster movies and like what they went on to do and why they didn't blow up. So good.
Amazing.
All of the content. That brings us towards the end of the show and the end of the season.
Do you want to do some reflections?
I actually do.
Let's talk about it. We've had three Academy Award ceremonies that we actually covered together.
We did.
This is the end of our first season, not the series, as you mistakenly mentioned at the beginning of the podcast.
Oops.
But we have covered a lot of movies.
Yeah, 13 movies.
We're going to be doing actually very close to that number with 1 year coming up.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot of things. Any notes? I mean, I know this is a second revisit for you on the podcast, but any notes on these 13 movies and your second revisit of them?
As far as the movies go, the first time I watched all of these movies, it was really an exciting journey. It was, I said it in our opening episode, like our Get to Know Us episode.
Episode zero.
Yeah. This was my chance to dive deeper into movies. I was kind of not a casual movie watcher, but, you know, I wasn't deep diving into the history of cinema or anything. And I'm still very much not well learned on a lot of different films. But that first go round gave me a look at some really incredible films Some films that have stuck with me and become favorites, like All Quiet on the Western Front and The Love Parade and Wings, which I've seen almost as many times as I've seen some of my favorite films released in the past 20 years. It's been a blast to revisit them. And not only revisiting them on my own, but revisiting them and getting to talk with you about it. It was nerve-wracking coming back to the podcast in a big way. It was kind of an emotional journey for me, and I had put it off for years. And it wasn't until we sat down, had coffee.
Mr. Tombstones.
Thank you for recommending that cherry bomb.
I need to get it again.
So good. But once we sat down and we talked, I was almost immediately certain that I wanted to continue doing the show with you. And I'm so happy that after 16 plus episode zero, 17 episodes of doing this, I have zero regrets. I am having a blast. And I am so glad that I made the decision to continue doing the show with you.
So let's see. Moments where I lost my mind. Jay Kelly, Sentimental Value, Train Dreams, this conversation. yeah, man, look, the same. It's been real. It's been kind of mind-blowing to have the ability to talk about movies and history. Mm-hmm. It's something that you never really thought was a possibility. I mean, I certainly didn't. We talked about this in episode zero. I majored in history for a while in college, and I just thought that that was something I really liked to talk about with people. And then I just realized that, I mean, I knew I liked movies at that point, but I just wanted to share movies with people. And you never really think that movie historian is something you can achieve. And, you know, God forbid one day you're able to, or I'm able to. But to be able to speak to the history here and to be able to, you know, share your company to talk about this, it's been truly an honor to be able to be a part of this and not even just, you know, like Jordan and like Antonia and be a guest on this, but to run it with you has been just an amazing thing to be a part of and to have an accomplishment under my belt, so to speak. So just happy to be on this run with you. I feel like it is a series finale the way we're talking about it, but we have a lot coming up. I'm very excited to talk about it. We're going to talk about it here in just a minute. But, you know, one thing that I love just a little bit more than older movies is where we are now. And I love keeping up with the zeitgeist of having these conversations with people. People don't really love talking about movies as much until it becomes Oscar season. And yeah. When it becomes Oscar season, people are now like, well, hey, I've heard about this one battle movie. And hey, what on earth is Hamnet? So there's a lot of conversation that's going to be had around these movies, and it's very exciting to kind of meet them halfway with, hey, we know about it, let's talk about it, but we've also talked about the previous nominees and you should check those out.
Right.
So there's a lot of people at my job who have stopped me and asked, like, hey, what year are you on now? And I'm like, you are not even remotely ready for me to tell you that we're still in the 1929, huh? Yeah. But they're interested, and mm-hmm. people are listening. And it's so cool. So, you know, one, thank you for having me on board in this journey to be able to speak with you about movies and history. But also thank you at home for listening, because this is something that has meant a lot to Kyle. It's something that means a lot to me. And if you haven't seen the video that we posted, we talk a lot about film preservation, even to today's standards, and going to theaters to see it. We had our Patriot episode where we talked about lost media. So just in these 16 episodes that you talked about, we've poured a lot of ourselves into it, and I'm looking forward to doing that even more with the movies to come. So it's been quite a time, and it's quite fitting that we're doing this on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, goals and reflections on the year prior. So I'm looking forward to a 2026 with you, my man.
Yeah.
It's going to be a good time.
Likewise. I'm so excited. And, you know, you thanked all of the listeners at home. One thing we haven't had an opportunity.
Not you, Bryce.
Yeah, Bryce. You're probably watching a movie right now.
Keep telling us the movies are bad.
Love you, Bryce. You mentioned thanking the audience at home. And one thing we haven't had the opportunity to do yet on one of these ceremony episodes is read audience responses and participation in emails.
Fan mail.
Exactly. Fan mail. So we did get one of those. It came in just shy of the last ceremony episode, but I did want to cover it before we
please
close the curtain on season one. So we have this from Caitlin. And Caitlin writes, and I do apologize if any of these emails ever have, like, praise for us. You know, I'm not sitting here like, and you guys are so great and you're wonderful. I'm just reading the emails.
And you're handsome and you're doing your best.
Yeah. So I'm just reading the email. But Caitlin writes, hello, Kyle and Ryan. I want to start off by saying I really enjoyed this episode and both your insights. I went to look for the movie to watch before listening, but I couldn't find it. Had no idea it's lost media. I assume she's referring to The Patriot.
The Patriot.
That was actually fascinating to think about. I guess I've never truly thought about film being lost. As a movie lover, I just assume movies are always readily accessible. Not the case. I liked how Stranger Things was brought up, how little things were added later. While I get it, sometimes it can take away from the original thoughts and plans. Ryan mentioning Small Soldiers took me right back to my childhood. I hadn't heard that title in years. I also love the parts about old commercials. Nostalgia hits differently as an adult. It's always nice to see little things from childhood that didn't seem important then, but feel meaningful now. I even found myself watching a few on YouTube. Your take on AI in film and its possible effect on storytelling for future generations was really thought-provoking. I can see how it could shake things up in interesting ways. I loved your emphasis on going to the movies and helping preserve them. It's so easy now to just rent the newest releases. I'll admit I've done that myself a few times. Laughing, sweaty face.
Same.
Smiley face. But there's something truly magical about experiencing films on the big screen with loved ones. Theaters offer a kind of nostalgia that can't be matched. I look forward to the next episode. Kate.
Kate, I'm a Gorgonite until I die. I'm going to keep mentioning Small Soldiers until I'm blue in the face. So.
Just because you can't see the air doesn't mean it's not there. Kate, thank you so much for writing in.
Yeah, thanks, Kate.
That was in regards mostly to the Lost Media episode we did. So again, I'm sorry that we didn't get that in for the second ceremony episode, but I'm really glad we were able to read it before the season ended.
Yep.
And just thank you so much for all of your kind words and for being a listener of the show. It really means a lot.
I mean, Kyle and I really are the ones running the Instagram and the email. So whenever you reach out to us, we are reading it. So we appreciate any mail that you send in, comments that you leave on our posts, messages that you leave on Discord if you're part of the Patreon. We'll talk about that here in a second. Thank you for reaching out and being on this journey with us. First season's over and we're looking forward to many more to come, but specifically some fun stuff coming in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah. So a little look into what we have upcoming. January, we're mostly going to be taking a break. The 2026 Academy nominations are going to come out January 22nd. What we will be doing is covering all of those nominees in real time in the same format we're doing every other year of the show. Mm-hmm. Wednesdays, Fridays, and Mondays if necessary.
It will be necessary.
Yes, it will. That's going to be the end of January after the nominees are announced, and then all of February.
Correct. And that will lead up into the Oscars ceremony in March.
Correct, yeah. We'll talk more about March as we get closer, because that's going to be a little wonky.
Yeah, we're going to see some overlap from us starting our 1931 coverage.
Yes. But very exciting. February is going to be dedicated to all of the modern releases. Something we haven't really talked about much yet.
Something that we have talked about a good bit on here is how you can watch the movies that we're talking about now, whether it be YouTube, Tubi, owning the Blu-ray, finding it somewhere available for purchase. It's exciting to be able to talk about something that has been in theaters and is available at home. Yes. In the highest definition possible. So there hasn't been a better time for you to get caught up with your Oscar movies than to listen with us. January 21st, we talk through our predictions of what's going to be nominated. Granted, we're recording this on the day that the Golden Globe nominations have actually dropped. Mm-hmm. So we're already doing our research of what we think is going to be nominated. We've done a lot of, I've posted on my Instagram and you on yours. Train Dreams is something we've both watched. I've done my research on other movies. So we have ideas of what we think might be a contender, whether it's Best Picture, Best Actor, yeah. But it's nice to get a little closer, and we'll have our predictions episode on the 21st of January to talk about it.
Yeah, so look forward to that. You'll get a little bit of a break from us for the next couple of weeks.
Just 3 weeks.
And then we'll be coming back strong with
ready
the 2026.
To go.
Yeah. And you'll be watching all of the Best Picture nominees.
Correct.
I'm going to do my best to complete another Oscars death race.
Man.
Where I watch all of the nominees. Hopefully I'll be able to make that happen, but you'll be able to keep up with all of the things that we're watching on our Instagram, on our TikTok. I'm going to make a, what is it called when I'm saying I'm going to do something?
Declaration
that I am going to commit to posting more on the social media accounts. I'm looking into doing a couple of different video formats and things, physical media reviews and clips from the movies and all of that. We'll both be working a little bit on things like that.
For sure.
And that's where you'll get to see us talk about the movies that we've seen for this upcoming Oscar season. And yeah, I'm just really excited. Once we finish the current year in February, March, then we'll be going all the way through the 30s to the end of December 2026. Well, I think 1939 will be our December coverage.
Correct.
I'm so excited. It's so cool.
It's crazy. We're going to get some heavy hitters. You know, I think that we ended this one on a pretty high with All Quiet on the Western Front, a pretty amazing guest. Thank you, Antonia, for joining the podcast. So looking forward to a couple of other heavy hitters in the 31 through 40 year.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. A call to action for all of you at home. Again, thank you so much for listening. Share this with a loved one. Share it with a friend. If you know someone who loves movies, send this their way. Maybe they'll enjoy exploring the history of films the same way that we do. Like and review the podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Follow us on all of our social media. And if you'd like to support the show in a financial way, please check out patreon.com/OUTAO podcast. You can get access to our community Discord there. We're going to be committing more to doing like maybe monthly watch parties. We'll watch a movie together over the Discord. And our long-term goal is to maybe add like a second once a month show. You know, we're still experimenting and seeing what we might want to do. But we would really appreciate the support if you choose to do so. If not, just thank you again for being a listener.
And maybe we'll drop a poll once we get to 1931. We'll drop a poll of what movie you'd want to watch the most with us.
Yeah.
We'll be able to post like what's on YouTube, Tubi, all the alike. So maybe we'll see what you guys want to vote on what you want to watch together.
Yep. And we haven't posted the Patreon poll yet because we filmed these episodes in advance. So we're still ironing out when we're going to announce those, but I think we're going to start committing to posting them on social media rather than announcing on the episode.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But that's really all I've got. Again, it's been a pleasure, Ryan.
Are you sending me off to sea? What is this?
It's been a pleasure, Ryan.
No, it's all
messed
good.
Up your name twice. I've called you Ryland twice.
That's okay. I've gotten my own name wrong plenty of times. No, it's been an honor, man, and I'm very much looking forward to many years, months, but years in real time to go through this as well.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to working with you on it.
We will be back January 21st with the nominees for the 2026 Oscars. And thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you, audience. Thank you, all the backers on Patreon. Thank you to all the listeners.
Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Antonia.
Exactly. That's going to do it for this episode and this season. As always, I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Ryan.
And we'll
see you at the movies.